All right, hello and welcome to the Animal Fire Podcast, Episode 5, Transformabots. This is going to be a fantastic episode. I'm really excited. We've got a very special guest, Christian Carvajal.
That's correct. And can I say, Austin, I just learned something by being a guest on your podcast, which is that intro is played live every time. And when he wants to fade out, he just backs away from the microphone into the kitchen.
Oh, yeah. This is the live theater of podcast
recording.
That's
analog,
recording.
Baby. That's low tech. I like it.
Oh, it's great. We do all our own sound effects. Carve, as he's known, is an actor and a director and a two-time novelist and the local Olympia Tacoma theater critic for the Weekly Volcano.
One of them with Joanne Varnell, yes. Yeah.
And I'm sure more. I'm sure you do more than that. You probably have hobbies and
I have
things.
A wife and yeah. I watch a lot of TV.
That's a great thing to put in someone's introduction. He's an actor, director, two-time novelist. He watches lots
of television. It's on my Playboy bio.
We're going to talk about theater criticism, or maybe we'll get off on a tangent about who knows what, but that's the plan, right?
Already people are sitting on the edge of their seats.
I know, theater criticism. This is our explosive episode.
It's incendiary.
but it is kind of incendiary, right? I mean, I bet
it used to get me hate mail.
Yeah. No more hate mail?
Over about the last year, I think people have finally realized that my heart's in the right place, that it's not personal, and I will hopefully review a friend as objectively as I review someone who's not a friend. But it took a while. I got some pretty nasty emails and comments for a long time.
Ow.
I used to lose sleep about it.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. It's got to be kind of hard when you write that rough review and then send it in. Does it make you nervous?
Usually it goes in no later than noon on a Monday. And then it used to be, we're under different management now, but for a long time it would come online on Wednesday afternoon and then hit print on Thursday. And the time between Monday and Wednesday or Thursday was really rough for me if I knew I had panned a show. It's especially difficult because, as you said, I still act and I still direct and I still make theater myself. So a lot of times when I walk into an audition or when I sit down to talk to crew members or whatever it is, I'm talking to people who I have said mean things about in public. And I don't think that really helps clear the room for me very well when I come in.
I'm sure it can make auditions difficult on either side of the table.
Yeah. I don't think I'd ever reviewed you badly.
No, I don't think you have.
Which helped tremendously.
No, yeah, that's why you got the part in my line. That's great. Carve also is playing Claudius in Animal Fire Theater's summer production of Hamlet, opening July 19th in Priest Point Park.
Directed by Austin Anderson Animal Fire Theater podcast fame.
Yeah. I really hope that the podcast becomes more famous than any plays Animal Fire Theater's ever done.
Director, speaker, Michael Bay appreciator, Austin Anderson.
Oh, that's her. That's incendiary.
I was lying about one of those things.
Yeah, we had a brief talk before we started this podcast about Transformers 1 and 2. And
about the nuance.
It's the Shakespeare of our time, the Transformers.
I think, actually, the name Optimus Prime sounds kind of Shakespearean.
It does kind of sound Shakespearean.
It wouldn't be Prime because that wouldn't scan. It would be like Panoptimus or something.
You're probably a bit too old for this, but there was a version I really liked as a kid where they turned into animals, and he was called Optimus Primal, and he became a gorilla, and I liked that.
You're right. That version doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it makes no sense.
I can see a robot turning into a truck or a soda machine, but a panther?
Yeah.
That's really pushing credulity right there.
Yeah, but it was a cartoon, and it sold a lot of toys.
I can see why Bay walked away from that one.
Yeah, he's like, no, let's do the one where they were cars. The animals is too much.
Right.
Let's get back on track.
We'll make them out of switchblades and transistors.
and they'll fight with karate.
I want to see the really mundane robots, like, who have to, like, turn into the arms that put the car together back on their home world.
That's the sad thing. You've seen them. You've seen the poor robot who's, like, Copier Secundus, who turns into a Xerox machine or something. And the other thing I love about those movies is that you always know it's an evil robot, because when they walk through them, they go... Like, I always think, wouldn't it be great if people did that? Like, you know, you go in for an audition, and the director goes, like, hi, my name is... You go, you know what, I think
Oh, he's evil. We should do that for... actually, I've heard about this. There was a director who did a Tartuffe. And
he's already suspect.
Right. And he hated the play. And so every time the character sat down, he had sound effects happen. And then they would
like
react.
Like flatulent sound effects?
Oh, like flatulence, or they make like a bong, like the spring noise. And I think his concept was, this play is so bad, the characters are bored.
Well, cycling back to me as a critic, that would make my job easy.
Yeah.
But painful for 2 hours, but then easy when I went to write about it.
Yeah, let's, for the love of God, let's cycle back to you as a critic.
None of this is making it in, I can tell already.
No, the thing is, we're not good enough editors.
Oh, jeez.
This is one take, whatever you say.
I used a vocabulary word for flatulent.
That's why when Ian swore, there's one podcast that's labeled explicit in our list.
I saw that. It sounds like you maybe had like a Howard Stern show or something for one week, but you didn't. It was just one little oops word.
We just had Ian. So let's talk about, how did you get started as a theater critic? Like when did this opportunity come about and genesis?
Okay. So I published my first novel. The other one's actually nonfiction. I published my first novel in November of 2009. And it came out with quite a bit of local fanfare. It did nothing nationally, but it did pretty well here locally. And then just about 2 weeks later, the Weekly Volcano's then critic got caught doing something he shouldn't have done. I can't get into that very much. But anyway, he was invited to seek employment elsewhere. And so they advertised for the position, and I was kind of underemployed at the time as an adjunct professor, and I thought, well, that might be a fun thing to do. So I put in for it, and then Matt Driscoll, the editor at the time, decided, what if we had three critics? It was myself, Joanne Varnell, and a guy named Joe Eisenman from Tacoma. And that, I think he was thinking, that way, if one of them messes up, I can fire them with impunity. Because I'll still have backup. And the way it worked out was Joe and Joanne wound up handling Tacoma and Lakewood, and I did Ole exclusively. So I've been Ole's, I don't want to say only theater critic, but I guess their premier theater critic for a while now. Alec Clayton, my friend and competitor, he now mostly works in Tacoma at the request of his editors. So I've been doing this since early December 2009.
Wow, okay. So, you said in the very beginning you got hate mail. Because you were probably not just a new critic to Olympia, but kind of the first time a lot of these shows were even getting reviews.
Well, I think Alec was doing a good job. I think it would be unfair to say they'd never been reviewed. But Alec is more political than me, and he reviews with, I think, a lighter touch than I do, if I'm being very candid. And so maybe people were used to not seeing words in print about them that sounded just flat out insulting. They'd never been panned. And the other complicating factor was I myself hadn't been in town at all for very long. I had only been here for about 2 years at that point. So very few people really knew me. And what happens is when all people know of you is your criticism column, they assume that you are a purely critical person. That all you do is walk around going, ah, this hamburger tastes terrible. Oh, I hate the sun. I'm tired of yellow light. You know, oh, people. Like, that's all you do. And so I think very naturally they just assumed that I was just a bad person and certainly worthy of being flamed back.
Just this ogre who sits in his tower, like, you know, angrily, like, shaking his fist at the world.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, this sort of constant curmudgeon. And then,
what really sealed the deal was we had a burlesque troupe start up in Olympia right about that time. And I was sent to review one of their programs. And when I got there, I realized there's no point in reviewing this because, A, it's never going to repeat. By the time this sees print, it won't matter. And B, they're very new and they don't really quite know what they're doing yet. And it would be a negative review that I don't want to write because I would actually like to encourage this troupe to keep progressing and working at it, which they have. And so my editor, based on that, decided that we, instead of writing a review, we would just kind of write a puff piece about how great it is that we have burlesque in Olympia. And the internet exploded. Because I hadn't reviewed them, it meant that I was sexist. Because I said they were attractive women, that just piled on. I mean, clearly I'm sexist, although I kind of thought the point of burlesque was to present attractive women. But, oh, it was bad. And then it just turned into this huge flame war on the Volcano comments board. Huge tempest in a teapot. And that really poisoned the water for months after that.
Wow, I had no idea. That's kind of a wild story.
Yeah. And people didn't just get angry. They got offended to their core. They got offended over things I didn't say because they thought I might say them. Like, I might have felt that way. And then suddenly it became reality and I was hearing about that. Any male friend who came on the board to defend me and say, you know, the guy does have a fiance that he gets along with and, you know, he has a mom and a sister and all that. Like, they instantly were chauvinists too. And I mean, in retrospect, it's been a few years now. In retrospect, I understand exactly how it all went down, but it just made it hard to look some of those people in the eye for a long time. And I bet back at me too.
Yeah, because Olympia is small enough that you're going to end up at the same restaurant or
you run into them all the time. And again, you run into them at auditions. Mm-hmm. So, hey, why don't you two play this love scene? And really you're thinking, I would choke you to death so fast, you know?
This is Olympia, too. I feel like people get offended to the core quickly.
It is Berkeley North. It is one of the reasons I moved here. I moved here from Oklahoma. And it was so refreshing to me that I was often the most conservative person in the room because that had not happened to me in a long time. It was nice to be in a place where my political and religious views or lack thereof weren't a huge liability. But yes, people are very touchy here. I think that's fair to say. And I think also there's this weird, like, unfairness inflation where, I mean, this is hugely off topic, mm-hmm. and yet it's not.
Yeah.
But I think that because a lot of young people here especially have never seen what I would call real discrimination. They've never been the victim of real, honest-to-God sexual discrimination or racial discrimination. Fairly minor offenses or misunderstandings take on huge cosmic weight, and they feel that can say something much broader about you than it really does. So if you crack a joke in the wrong crowd, that may be the most discriminatory thing that's happened to them in a year. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes the thing they focus on most.
Yeah, and it's got goods and bads, right? Like, it's good because Olympia...
It's good that we've gotten to that point, yes. For one thing.
And that there are people who have that kind of freedom to actively think about that kind of stuff.
But where they feel free enough to vent it.
Yes, but sometimes... hiring, but you know what, maybe that's just me being a straight white male and not I oppress everybody no matter what I do or where I go. It's very difficult,
and I'm in the same boat. Yeah. But I think what a lot of these young people don't realize is I've been in their camp since before they were born. I mean, I've been fighting that good fight. I was fighting it when it was a lot less popular than 2012 in Washington State. I mean, try it in 1985 in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And there were people before me who had an even more difficult fight. But, you know, we see things through our own filter and our own timeline, and there you go.
All right, let's get meandered again, which I love, actually. I love me.
Well, I think it is relevant to criticism because, especially with theater in Olympia, I often find myself reviewing shows that have a very particular political objective
or some might say tirade, you know. Olympia loves to preach to the converted in their theater, and so I wind up often having to be very delicate about things. For instance, here's one that comes up a lot, and really only gay critics get to talk about it, so I'm out of line even for bringing it up. But there are times when an actor is too visibly, I don't want to say gay because that's not correct, but visibly, let's say, mannered in a certain way for the role they're playing. I have seen a play in the last year where supposedly the lead was this huge ladies' man. And in fact, the actor playing him either, well, let's just say that the impression given was that he would not maybe be a ladies' man.
Okay.
It did affect how good the play was. It absolutely did. It was a huge problem with the play. But you really have to tap dance around that and find ways to say it so that you're not going to get a barrage of hate mail. You can't just say, oh, actor X really kind of came off too gay to play this role he's playing. I'm not saying it can't be done. Neil Patrick Harris plays, a man about town. But this guy couldn't do it. And I couldn't say so. Not in Olympia. I might have been able to say it in Oklahoma. I couldn't say it here.
That's an odd thing you would say. Oh, I could say it in Oklahoma, where
they're not as progressive.
Yeah, but it would probably go rougher for that actor in Oklahoma, whereas Olympia would be a much safer place to be that type of person, and then the walls are built around.
But I mean, think of that as a director too. Let's say, and you know, may never have happened to you, but let's say you had an actor in your cast that you really needed to butch up for the part they're playing. It's tricky for a director. How do you go about saying that in a way where all the other kind of greeners in the cast aren't going to go, hey, you know, you troglodyte, we've progressed past that. It hinders communication sometimes.
I get caught up because there are people who are running circles that are more progressive with pronouns than I am. He and she are, they have different meanings to those different groups, and people want to eschew them for personal reasons. And it's just something I never grew up with and I never had any awareness of. And so I don't ever think about it. There's only he and she in my world still.
Right, right.
And so sometimes with Shakespeare, when I'm switching the gender of a character or playing with something more ambiguous, it gets convoluted and I have a very complicated talk with somebody who's got more progressive ideas about that than I do, and we kind of have to find a middle ground between the two of us.
Well, it comes up as a writer, too, because a generation ago, he was the generic pronoun. That's what you use for a person of indeterminate gender or, you know, unimportant gender or whatever. But you can't do that now, and sometimes it makes for some very twisted Dickensian sentences trying to get around having to use a simple pronoun. And when you're on a word count, like I usually have tops 550 words for an article, you're trying to cut wherever you can, and it makes things tricky.
Oh, that's interesting. So I didn't realize. I just thought there was kind of a natural
just right size till you're done.
Right till you felt like you've told the show what you need to say.
No, it used to be 300 words for online reviews, 550, maybe 600 for the print reviews. But I have noticed lately that the way they've reformatted our paper, that if I write more than 500 words, there's a good chance some of it will be cut. So, for instance, I just reviewed Summer Session at Harlequin this morning. I saw it last night. I really enjoyed it, and I wanted to write about it at some length. 550 is about the most I can get. And I would be very surprised if the editor doesn't cut the first paragraph, which can change the whole impression left by the article. He's cut the last paragraph before, which can really be deceptive.
Have you ever read one of your articles that had a paragraph cut and felt like something positive accidentally came off more negative, or like the tone changed?
Yes, I reviewed Perfect Wedding at Olympia Little Theater recently, and what I saw in that show was a good play with some very green actors who were learning. And OLT, especially over the last year, has been really good at teaching actors. They've turned out some pretty good Shakespearean actors over a year of study and practice. And my last paragraph of the play said something like, hey, listen, I've seen this work for OLT in the past. If these actors will keep at it, they're promising, and, you know, they might even be better a year from now. And that paragraph was cut. So I think the last thing that was said was something like, yeah, it's a good script, but it ends clunky and thud, you know, or whatever. Like, it really gave the impression that it wasn't worth your time and money, which it was.
And that paragraph... kind of sad, actually, because that's the paragraph that can keep somebody acting and make them feel like they've got something to follow through on.
Yeah, and you know, we're kind of lucky at the Volcano because for the most part we write our own titles and subtitles. Sometimes that's subject to editorial change, but for the most part it's what we wrote. And in most papers, that's not the case. Usually you write a review, you send it in, and then the editor says, you know, show reminds me of manure or something, like whatever. You know, he picks some word that he thinks is interesting in your article, and suddenly that's the title. And for people who are just skimming, or, God, especially for actors who are looking for the glorious review of their fine efforts, and then that's what they see.
Actors skimming for their character name.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is... probably half my readers.
So that last paragraph from the Perfect Wedding review made me kind of wanted to ask this anyway. But so, what do you think the value is of reviewing theater in a town like Olympia?
Well, I see my job as threefold. One, and most important, I see myself as a consumer advocate. We are very blessed in Olympia, particularly, to have a lot of good theater. Most of the time, there are three or four shows going on, but people only have so much money. And so I see my job as, okay, you know, maybe your money, which is limited, would be better spent here than there. I realize this show maybe has a more attractive title or is more familiar to you, but you might try investing it over here. So that's one. Two... I see myself as sort of the final accountability for theater. I think, and I say this as an actor and director myself, I think we have a tendency to be lazy, and I think we have a tendency to pat ourselves on the back where it's not deserved and say, because I actually got the show staged, because it actually got in front of an audience and nobody broke an arm, what a creative genius I am, when in fact it could be much better than that. So I see myself as sort of the last yes or no on the show. And as a director especially, I value that. I value somebody who can look at my work and say, hey, the guy still got it, or hey, maybe he needs to look at X, Y, or Z. And then third, I do have readers. I find out about them every once in a while who don't see the shows, maybe don't care about theater at all. They just enjoy my writing. And so there's a responsibility to be kind of entertaining. And that can lead to some kind of whimsical turns of phrase that also gets me hate mail, because people feel like their work isn't being taken seriously enough. They're major talents, and you know, they deserve to be treated like Ibsen or Chekhov, you know. Maybe they do, but I still have to entertain people who are just reading it with their coffee at Batdorf's.
That the hate mail thing interests me because you know, you've reviewed shows I've done.
I think two, right? Haven't I reviewed two of them?
Yeah, because this is my third show in Olympia. And like you said, you gave me good reviews, and you know, that's great. You know, everyone likes that. Everyone likes that accolade. But you know, there was still criticism in there, which is what I think is always even better. Like, I'm a big fan of, you know, like you said, always trying to say, okay, you did the show. That's great, but you know, always striving to improve.
You'll remember it better than I did. Did you agree with the criticism?
Yeah, I did. I did. But my point is this: I remember, you know, you would have one little line of criticism about maybe an actor who you weren't a super fan of, or you thought, oh, they could have maybe gone a different direction with that, in an otherwise pretty glowing review.
Sure.
And that actor would take that to heart so strongly. I just remember they'd be like, I can't believe this review. And did you see this review? Did you see what he said?
Right. Did you get this guy's an idiot?
I didn't get that. It was a lot of like,
I get
just
that
outrage.
A lot. I get you're an idiot. Or if I liked a show
Now, understand, if I liked a show, it probably deserved it. I've been doing this a while. I've been doing theater since I was 7 years old. I know a good show from a bad show. If I liked a show, it probably merited that. And then people say, wow, what a great review. Like, oh, this guy. But what they don't realize is that a negative or panning review can still be a great review. It can still be a sign that I know what I'm doing. It can still be useful to the company. Now, I sympathize with directors because, especially in the situation I'm in where I've now established some kind of cred, if I criticize a performer's work after the first weekend, there is a real tendency for that performer to then go over the director's head or however, and change that to match what I thought it should have been. And, you know, the director has every right to say, hey, it's still my show, my vision. Right or wrong, it's still the way we're going to do it. But it has gotten back to me that people self-directed after reading my work.
I was thinking too, you know, it can be hard if you do get that bad review, because I've noticed that the good review always yields bigger audiences. Now, whether that's just the second weekend and promotions doing better, I don't know, but it can't hurt.
I have always wondered how much good my reviews do in terms of boosting attendance at a good show. I think it can only help. Part of that is self-selection. I mean, if you get a good review from me, you're going to put it on your website. You're going to,
yes.
You know what I mean? You're going to tout it. If I say, well, this show kind of sucks, you're not going to put that out there. But I don't know of an example where people have just stopped going to a show because I hated it. I do know of examples where maybe a little bit of bump came out of my review.
A bit of a stumble, maybe, until...
Maybe. But see, that's... A lot of theater companies and theater company directors think that's my job, is to be their free publicist.
Yes.
And I have gotten that phone call where, hey, we rely on you for ticket sales. Well, then you're dumb, because that's... I don't work for you.
And you... There are times, I'm sure, where there are more shows than you can see and review.
Oh, absolutely. And God... Oh... If there's, and for some reason, shows always come out on the same day, too. That's a big deal in Olympia and a lot of other places. Everything comes out on Thursday, the whatever. Yeah. So there's only so much me. If I miss a show, oh, that is a dreadful insult to that company. But I have to go to the companies that have the most established reputation.
Yeah. But, you know, like you say, if there are three shows running the same weekends and you're in a show,
then it's impossible.
Yeah, you know, what can you do?
Dow, Theater Artists Olympia, has Titus Andronicus opening the same weekend as Hamlet. I have every reason to believe it'll be a great show. I was at the director's auditions. I saw people who were cast. I think it's going to be great. She's got some good people in the show. There is no way I will be able to see that the first weekend, or first, I can't see an early rehearsal, really, unless it was so early it doesn't apply.
Yeah.
Maybe I could see it second weekend, but probably not. So since there's only me, I don't think they're going to get a volcano review from us.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for them, because I'm sure they could use the bump.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah, it's rough. Well, even you being in our show
means you won't get reviewed.
Exactly, yeah. And I'm curious to see how that affects us. I'm actually it'll be a good control group against the other 2 years where you did review us, and I felt like a bump came afterwards.
Well, I am trying to balance it by, you know, as we get closer, I will drop mentions into my reviews of other people's shows, especially if it's true, where I'm saying things like, oh, I've been thinking about Subject X for a while because I'm playing Claudius in Hamlet, coincidentally opening, blah, blah, blah. You know, I may do some of that, but there's only so much of that you can get away with.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and that really... You know, that's great, but like you said, you know, you've got 550 words.
That's what I got.
To do the one.
And they're owed all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we jumped ahead. I want to go back and finish my thought about slight bit of criticism about one actor in an otherwise glowing review, where that actor really took it to heart, and nothing I could, and this might have just been the actor being fussy. It was the actor being a very fussy person.
I was about to ask you if we can name names, but now we can't. Okay.
No, it doesn't matter. They're not in the area anymore.
Okay.
So even it doesn't matter either way. But the point is, no matter what I told him about, look, the whole review is glowing. This is a fantastic review.
Right. He only hated you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cheer up.
But the thing is, you had other part. There were even other lines in the review saying, oh, he did a great job here, here, and here. Like the same actor.
Oh, but maybe he didn't have this quality that would have been helpful.
And it was, you know, I think it was even something like, and I wondered if he had thought about this or done this, if it might have enriched his performance. But, you know, as the writer of these things, though, what would you want actors to take away when you critique them? Like, what's the thing you'd want to tell them?
Well, let me say first, I have received bad reviews myself. I was in a review of Broadway musicals, and they gave me If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof. And the review said, now keep in mind, by the way, I was like 22 at the time, okay? The review said, well, Carvajal, misspelled my name, is a dead ringer for Topol, who was the older middle-aged Greek gentleman who played the role in the movie, but he could show more enthusiasm. Now, to be fair, that was true. I was completely unimpressed by Fiddler on the Roof at the time and didn't want to, but he caught me, okay? And yeah, I took that to heart. Even worse, when I was a director once, I did a show that was about a black barbershop in Chicago during the time of the race riots. And because there was so little theater available aimed at black audiences at the time, it was a huge popular hit. Oh, it was standing O's, people hugging each other and crying. And I knew the show wasn't actually very good. But much like Tyler Perry, you know, the bar was set low. So it was very successful. And then we had an adjudicator come in who was a professional critic. And the way it worked was he would review your show to your face. In the room, he would look right at you in the eye and tell you what he thought. And there were audience members, select audience members in the room. So we had a room packed with black people who thought I was terrific. And then this kind of crusty-looking white guy gets up in front of the room and he says, now, you, the director, and he points right at me. He says, you brought nothing to this show that wasn't already in the script. Which, as a director yourself, is there any worse thing you can hear? That you were unnecessary to the process, that they'd have been better off if you never walked in.
That's probably the worst thing.
That's like, that is deflating. I mean, and the thing is, he was right. Now, I knew, just as the people I review know, all the struggles I had to go through to even get the thing staged. I knew that I had worked myself into exhaustion to make it happen. But he was right. The fact of the matter was, the best I was able to accomplish was to kind of catch up to the script, which was very good. So the few times I've gotten really, really harsh reviews, I knew I deserved it. And I think that's worse. If that happens to you and you're an actor, if somebody says something negative to you and you know you're right, I would say, I'm not your mom. I'm not your Uncle Harry. I'm not your best friend. I don't have a bias. Even if I am friends with you, I do my best to set that aside when I walk into the room. And your mom doesn't. So, I wasn't saying it to be mean. There might be some truth to it. And if you're serious as an actor and you want to grow, I think you owe it to yourself to kind of think about that and judge for yourself whether maybe it is true. Now, if I say something to you and you decide it's not true at all, there's any number of ways you can explain it away. The director told me to do it. Hey, I didn't write this stuff. You should have seen me the next night when I was glorious. Hey, I got a standing O. It's just one man's opinion. Hey, what do you know? You're just some guy who writes for an alt news. I mean, there's any number of ways you can explain it away. But I might be right. Now, don't put that to work now because you still have to do what the director wanted. But in your next show or at your next audition, maybe it's a way to grow. I mean, what better way?
Yeah, it's like you said about the Fiddler on the Roof. You weren't excited.
I wasn't.
And
he
caught you. And you...
Lesson being, it reads.
You got to take a hard look at that. Like I said, I like criticism can be good because you've got a completely impartial voice, which is nearly impossible to find. Anyone I could convince to come see my show and talk about it knows me to some degree and is going to be partial. But to get that voice that's completely impartial, can be really valuable to see things you never would see on your own.
Well, I'm not going to flatter myself to say I'm completely impartial. I don't think anybody could be. But what I will say is, and you know, maybe the gentleman protests too much, but I will say that my heart is in the right place. I want the show to be good because I got to see it. Every show I walk into, I am hoping it just floors me with how good it is. Furthermore, I have been a young actor. I've been an inexperienced actor. I work with a new company and I'm introduced to a new directing or acting method. I realize I know nothing about it. It's constantly humbling. There's room for growth in all of us. But I want actors to succeed. I'm a director too, and nothing is better for me than 1,000 fantastic actors in my town. That is the best case scenario. And I also believe that a rising tide lifts all ships. That if every actor is held to a high standard, every actor will have to meet that standard.
Yeah, I like that. It's a bit like that advice people give that I think more people should listen to about auditioning. To remember that when you walk in, it's the director's dream that you're amazing.
Yeah.
They want you to be good because if you're good and you fit their show, their lives just got so much easier. They're just sitting in a room hoping this show comes together if they're doing that kind of casting.
Yeah, and it's all on them. I mean, the buck stops with the director. Them rather than him or her. I did that pronoun thing.
Yeah.
I'm also directing a show for Lakewood Playhouse that kind of really ramps up right after Hamlet closes. And we just had auditions. And there are good actors in Lakewood, and we had some good actors from Oli show up. Now, I had to say no thank you to some very good actors. I don't think... And you'll relate to this. I don't think actors who don't direct realize how superficial it can be sometimes that you picked between two very good actors because one was taller or one was blonde or something about their voice. Just, you know, they had a trace of an accent, or it can come down to very, very simple, superficial things that say nothing about your work or your quality as a person or an actor. And people don't realize that. And, you know, Lakewood Playhouse sends out a fairly generic email. They've done that for 4 shows now, saying, hey, you were great, but we couldn't use you. Thanks, try again. And people got that email, and it's gotten back to me that people were offended that they didn't get more personal feedback. But what would it be? It would be, oh, I needed somebody 2 inches taller than you. Or
yeah. Yeah, that,
you know.
Sometimes what people don't realize, like you said, your hand is forced as a director.
Yeah.
You see someone, you think they would be so amazing in this show if everybody else in my cast was 15 years older.
Right.
Otherwise, they're just right. It's going to look so weird.
That totally happened with me on Sherlock. And sometimes it's chemistry, too. And I don't care how good an actor you are, you can't create chemistry with every other good actor. It's indefinable. Nobody ever teaches how to do it because nobody knows how to do it. But sometimes your chemistry in an audition just didn't work with the other people in the room. And so you get a no, even though independent of them, you would have been the best choice.
Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, that's another like criticism, learning to take not getting cast just kind of a skill and a way of thinking. You have to really shape your mind around. And I did not understand it because I studied acting in school until I started doing directing. And then my teacher said, come to the big general auditions for the school with me and sit next to me and watch this. And then you watch them, and you, like, your eyes just open the entire time. You're like, oh, it's like that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Why was I worrying about X, Y, and Z when it was always this simple?
And sometimes, yeah, you're right. Sometimes it is obvious who the right person is. And it doesn't matter how good anybody else is. It's just going to be that person, you know? We talked a little bit about the gay thing. But, you know, speaking of superficial, as a critic, how do you say actor X was too fat for the role? Especially if it's a dance role.
That's hard. You had a great podcast about this. We should plug your podcast.
Oh, please do. Yeah. By all means. It's on christiancarvajal.com.
Yes.
The H sounds like a... No. What sounds like an H is really a J.
And yeah. It's called Carve's Thinky Blog, right?
Carve's Thinky Blog. We'll turn it up on Google.
Yeah, and you had a great one. I think it was your first one out of the shoot about being fat and calling people fat and the whole taboo around fat.
Yeah. We should be empowering fatness.
Yes. But that, you're right. That's hard. How do you, acting is super personal, and you got to have a thick skin. But, you know, then the people who are writing the criticism have to be. That's a fine line. How do you straddle that line?
Well, and as a director, I philosophically and politically believe very strongly in gender blind casting, ethnicity blind casting, sexuality blind casting, and size blind casting wherever possible. But that last little disclaimer is really a huge disclaimer, because sometimes you need a character to give a certain impression, and whether they mean to be or not, your audience has certain visual biases. And so if you put, let's say, a corpulent Romeo together with a svelte Juliet, all people in the audience are going to be thinking, no matter how politically aware and progressive they are, is he'd never get her. Come on. Who are we kidding here? Yeah. And it will affect the impact of the show. And so in my role as a consumer advocate, as a critic, I have to keep that in mind and say, okay, this person may be a very good actor. Now, I'm overweight myself, but I have to keep aware as an actor that that reads as certain personal qualities. Whether it's fair or not, that's how we are. We have evolved that way. And so as a critic, I have to put myself in the mind of an audience member who isn't your Uncle Bob or your mom, who comes into the show and they've never seen you before. And all they're going to do is think, am I comfortable with this person doing these things? Do I believe that would happen? Now, we all know people of all different stripes get paired together and they make wonderful couples. But it never happens in the movies, and it almost never happens on TV, except sitcoms where it's always like some super hot, thin woman with a big, fat, middle-aged guy who had a stand-up career. But we never believe it. We never believe it's really true. We never believe that that guy would be married to that woman. And maybe they would in real life. Maybe they are in real life, but we don't believe it. And I don't know that that will go away in my lifetime.
It seems to me it's the kind of thing where you can't just do it and say, oh, no, it's Romeo and Juliet. Everyone will buy that they're in love. You could do it if you found some way to make it really, really worth it. Like, that'd be a very special, very different version of that show. But you can't just do it and say it'll work because we should be blind about this casting.
Yeah. And, you know, a friend of mine, Chris Cantrell, directed a production of Romeo and Juliet where Romeo and Julian or whatever, maybe you just called him Juliet, were two young gay men. Okay? Sounded like a great concept in the room. There was some debate about it. The politics of the thing aside, the problem with that was the play is not about these families are fighting because they're homophobes. The play is about these families are fighting because they hate each other. And it's not about, oh, this poor couple. It's about this family feud. And if you make that kind of a brave political choice, which may be a terrific high concept, you are arguing with the playwright at every step. And I think that it was, Cantrell handled it as well as you could possibly do it. But ultimately, he was trying to rewrite the play. And as a critic, you have to be aware of that kind of thing. Doesn't mean that I'm against gay marriage. I'm all for gay marriage. I've been for it a long time, but not in Romeo and Juliet. And if you've only got 550 words, making that distinction and saying, I'm really a good person, but...
Do you think you also owe it to your readers when somebody takes a known quantity like a Shakespeare and really twists it hard and tries to change it to kind of let them know, look, if you go in thinking you're getting Romeo and Juliet in some doublets and stuff, you're not going to get that?
Well, I think people now assume that Shakespeare will be transported from its time and place, largely because Elizabethan costumes are much more expensive now than they were in the Elizabethan age. The problem with that is, director of modern-day dress Hamlet, with that is to say, well, it's cheaper is not a good enough rationale. So to fully justify it, you have to make the whole world of the play consistent. People have to, you know, you have to look at questions like, why are they all carrying swords, which you have. And, you know, then as a critic, it's my job to kind of assess whether you had a good enough answer for that question. But I will know if you haven't asked it. And so my responsibility is not to warn people,
I know you're hoping for tunics and doublets, but you actually get suits and dresses. My responsibility is to look at it and say, well, is the world as I'm seeing it now self-consistent? For instance, Titus Andronicus will be set in a 70s era motorcycle gang. It begs the question, then, why do they keep talking about Rome? Well, the Ralph Fiennes Coriolanus dealt with that right up front. Yes, they're going to say Rome a lot, but it's just some city called Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's harder to do that when you don't have super titles and captions and all that kind of stuff. So that's my responsibility is, once you've said this is the world you're in Act 1, Scene 1, do we actually stay in that world until the end of Act 5?
That's good, because I like that. I'm a really big fan of creating those full worlds. And when I watch a show, I tend to be picky about, well, that's not the same thing. You're right. That's not the same thing you did in Act 1. You've jumped through the slider's portal on this one.
Yeah. Why is he sending a messenger when he's got a cell phone?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they using swords as a motorcycle gang when they'd all be packing heat?
Yeah.
Why, you know, why? And I think, I may be wrong about this. I often wonder. But whereas I think a lot of directors think, oh, they'll just go along for the ride. They're just listening to the beauty of the language. I think even the average audience member, whether they mean to be or not, immediately fastens on things in the world that don't make sense. That leave maybe not even plot holes, but world holes. That world doesn't make sense. And they may not be able to articulate why they weren't pulled into the world, but all of a sudden you find that those explosive moments you're looking for, those moments of intensity and urgency, don't happen. And jokes don't land, and people don't swoon at the romantic or the sexual scenes. And when there's a fight scene, people yawn and cough and look at their programs. And as a director, you don't know why it is. But the reason is they believe they are watching actors act rather than people interact.
It's funny, too, because I don't think it needs to be. It can be anything. As long as your world is complete, you've done it. You know, I've seen productions where I've been engrossed by people who have all imaginary swords. Or, you know,
yeah.
You know, you buy it. It's when there's the sour note or the inconsistency that knocks you out of it. And that's a weird thing. You know, it's not so much, oh, you didn't choose something realistic enough. It's wasn't consistent enough.
And that's the danger of soliloquies in Shakespeare. They are by nature artificial.
Yeah.
People don't yell deep thoughts at the wall. They just don't. I don't do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think most sane people do. It's all internal. So that's the trick for actors and directors, and Hamlet's full of those moments. You know, Jay's dealing with that now. Why am I saying all this? Who am I talking to? What's going on? Claudius has the advantage. He's talking to God.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's very easy to do that. I have only one real long soliloquy. And I know who I'm talking to. And we're out in the park where I can look up at the sky, and it works great. Jay's got how many soliloquies in your cut?
I think it's down to just soliloquies. There's 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right, not counting all the lines that are just artificially long. I have some of those, too.
Yeah, you know, he gives big, long monologues to people sometimes.
Right.
But I think there's just the four he's
so
by himself.
So in a much more esoteric way, you also not only have to build a world that makes sense technologically, but you have to build a world where psychologically it makes sense that these people do all this heightened stuff. That, you know, whereas in Shakespeare's time, because they hadn't met kings and queens or seen them at length on CNN, they could just assume that kings and queens talked in iambic pentameter all the time. They were that good, you know? They were graced by God with the throne. They must be superhuman. We don't think that way now. We think of kings and queens maybe as more fallible than us.
I have never thought of that thought before. That's amazing that the people watching these shows just assumed that kings and queens talked to themselves at length.
They may have, because all they had ever seen is people doing the queen wave, hello, from a parade, if they'd ever seen it at all. And they had been raised from birth to death to believe that the reason those people in the monarchy have the throne is God put them there. If they didn't believe that, there would have been a lot more insurrections.
There were enough insurrections believing that.
Yeah.
So let's... I think it's about time we started to wrap this one up.
Aww.
I know this is super fun. You've got to come back and do this again. This is great. was really great. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think we've said all we need to say. Actually, I was going to say final thoughts, but your thoughts were so well-developed, they're already final.
I think I would add that everyone in Hamlet is outstanding and sexy, and quite possibly just better people than you've ever met before.
I would agree.
And that's why you should go see it. Exactly. It's free, too.
So. And it's free, so you have no excuses.
None. In fact, you're kind of a bad person if you don't go.
Really are.
I mean, let's be honest. You really aren't justifying your carbon.
All right. Well, if
I hear a guitar fading in.
Oh, no. He's
from the kitchen.
Yeah, as he plays from the kitchen. All right. So, as always, if you have any thoughts or comments, animalfiretheater.com/facebook.com/animalfiretheater, animalfiretheater.com,
and weeklyvolcano.com.
And weeklyvolcano.com, and Carve Stinky Blog. Thanks, Carve.
Thanks, Austin.